Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is Brennan v. Connors. Mr. Kiyanka?
Is there any significance to the fact that Brennan and Connors appeared before Murphy? It sounds like a meeting of the Irish Fellowship.
Your Honor, I'm afraid I can't answer that question. Good morning, Your Honors. I am Edward Kiyanka, and I represent Edward Brennan. This is a declaratory judgment action involving a bilateral indemnity agreement, which is part of a settlement contract between three former law firm partners, including Brennan, and a former client, James Connors. The district court dismissed the complaint under Rule 12b-6. There are four errors in the district court's decision. First, in interpreting the indemnity agreement as impotent because it has an infinite loop of indemnity. Second, in construing the indemnity agreement as failing to cover indemnification for one's own misconduct. Third, in holding that the indemnity agreement violates Illinois public policy, or, as it finally held in the alternative, that it could not find that the agreement did not violate Illinois public policy because there was no Illinois authority directly in point. And fourth, in overlooking or ignoring the governing Illinois public policy, which is the policy favoring freedom of contract. As to the first point, I don't need to spend much time, excuse me, I hope, on the infinite loop argument. The language of the indemnity agreement, which is at page 16 of our appendix, provides that the parties will indemnify claims, quote, regarding the contract referenced in the complaint, or, quote, arising out of the allegations in the complaint. The complaint that's referenced is the 1998 complaint in Brennan and the law firm, BCC, versus the Connors defendants, and the contract is the Connors representation agreement.
You know, just when you get right down to it, though, this is a case where a former partner says, you screwed me by not telling me the true facts of what was going on here. And your claim is that somebody else has to step in and pay the bill if they're right.
Yeah, that was the very risk.
Doesn't seem right.
Yeah, that's the risk that this agreement was designed to protect against. The whole purpose of the settlement agreement, this is part of a larger settlement agreement, was to protect against future claims, specifically by former partners or shareholders, among others. And everyone was aware, Your Honor, district court here treated this almost like a motion for summary judgment, converting a Rule 12b-6 motion into a motion for summary judgment, because it took into consideration all the documents that have been filed in this case and in 406, which was the underlying case, which had first been filed in state court, then removed, and then remanded back to state court. And Judge Murphy took judicial notice of all those documents in ruling on this issue. Those documents show very clearly that the parties were fully aware that there was a possibility of somebody claiming that somebody had done something wrong, had misrepresented or done something with respect to the contract here with James Connors.
Right,
and the fees.
Irrespective of the contract, what in the world did Connors do wrong, if anything? He didn't do anything wrong.
Well, Your Honor, that's not the respectfully.
Answer the question. Other than put the contract aside, there's no claim you could make against Connors, correct?
Well, there was a claim in the 1998 lawsuit, Your Honor, and that claim was settled, and the parties, you know, that was paid. Connors paid money. We don't know the exact amount, but Connors paid money to settle that 1998 lawsuit, and then everybody agreed this was settled. The case was settled. And there would be no further claims. And the whole purpose of this is not to fix blame or to say somebody did something wrong. The purpose of this was this agreement is to allocate risks, to allocate the risk that somebody would come back later and make a future claim. If this agreement isn't valid or if it doesn't cover this situation, then the settlement is a nullity. The settlement doesn't mean anything because nobody is safe. Anybody could come up with a future claim. Now, of course, there are defenses in the underlying case to this claim, but those are not involved in this declaratory judgment proceeding.
Why would Connors agree to identify Brennan? What would be the motivating force? What's his interest? What explain to me what benefit Connors has.
But it was a mutual agreement to indemnify. Everybody was agreeing to indemnify everybody else to protect against future claims. That was to benefit everybody. Everybody benefited.
So there is a scenario you would suggest where Connors would risk liability if he didn't indemnify Brennan.
Well, his liability would only be under this agreement. His only liability is under this agreement. I mean, we're simply seeking to enforce the agreement as it's written, Your Honor.
Well, I'm just trying to make little sense of the agreement. I'm trying to track the benefits.
Well, the benefit is that everybody could go home. Everybody could know that this settlement finally resolved this fee issue. This fee issue had been going on for a long time. And there were possible claims. In fact, if you look at the settlement that was entered into only 19 days before the settlement in this case, this was a release given by Michael Constance, the plaintiff in the underlying case here, to the Connors defendants. And in this release, this is document 25-5, in this release, Constance releases Connors from any and all claims, actions, demands, etc., whatsoever, including but not limited to any rights to recovery to be claimed under any written representation agreements that might exist between Connors and Brennan. That's the agreement. That's the essence of this case. Including but not limited to any claims for fraudulent concealment made thereunder. There's a specific reference here, only 19 days before this, to the risk that somebody is going to claim fraudulent concealment with respect to the transaction here, the fee transaction involving these shares of stock. So that's what everybody received. Everybody received they allocated this risk. As we've suggested in our brief, Your Honors, the controlling public policy here is the policy favoring freedom of contract, which the Illinois Supreme Court has stated repeatedly. We've cited several recent leading cases on that issue, saying that parties are free to allocate these risks, including risks that there might be a claim of intentional misconduct. We're not talking about future conduct. We're talking about conduct in the past, and that's the key distinction in this case. The parties are allocating a risk that there would be a claim made about some past misconduct that would be claimed to be intentional. The alleged fraud here was simply the fraud of omission, was a fraud of non-disclosure. Well, non-disclosure can be a fraud, but that is a risk that the parties were allocating in this settlement agreement. And all we're asking is that the settlement agreement be enforced in accordance with its terms, because it benefited everybody. As to the infinite loop argument, I don't know if I need to address that in detail.
Well, you might as well touch that. That's another good argument, by the way.
I'm sorry.
I think it's a reasonably good argument, by the way.
Well, Your Honor, if you simply read the agreement, it says that the indemnification is with regard to the contract referenced in the complaint or arising out of the allegations in the complaint. Those allegations reference the representation agreement, the Connors representation agreement, and the allegations in the complaint referenced were with reference to the failure to pay what was due under that agreement. Now, the indemnity agreement says that if someone is required to pay, if someone is sued and is successfully sued under the settlement agreement, then that party is entitled to indemnity, not because of the allegations in the 1998 complaint or because of the transactions in the 1998 complaint. The anything paid would be under the indemnity agreement itself. In other words, there's no infinite loop because the indemnity agreement, the first payment under the indemnity agreement would be a payment under the indemnity agreement and not with reference to the earlier transaction. Any other interpretation, Your Honors, would make all reciprocal or bilateral indemnification agreements meaningless, because there'd always be dueling claims once a party sought indemnity. It's familiar law. A court will not interpret agreements so as to nullify provisions or make them meaningless. It's also familiar a contract should be interpreted in accordance with the ordinary expectations of reasonable people. By its terms, this indemnity agreement does not cover a claim arising out of the indemnity agreement itself. The district court's interpretation would effectively nullify the whole settlement, and obviously that's not what the parties intended. The second question is, does the language of the indemnity agreement provide for indemnity for one's own misconduct? And I've already addressed that issue in answering earlier questions. It's also familiar law. The settlement agreement must be interpreted as a whole, viewing all of its provisions in light of the other provisions and in the context of the settlement itself. The language is quite clear in this case. Brennan, BCC, and the Connors defendants were settling a lawsuit involving an alleged breach of contract and a breach of fiduciary duty. The major issue in that case was the fee owed and the status of the 458,000 shares of RGC Gaming stock. The plaintiffs in the suit were being settled were Brennan and BCC, and all the parties knew there were issues as to how that fee should be divided and whose fee it was. In addition, as I mentioned, if we look at all these documents, as the district court did, we see that the settlement 19 days earlier specifically referenced the possibility of a fraudulent concealment. So this indemnity agreement would be of no value, or little value, if it didn't cover a claim such as this. A court should not interpret a contract to nullify it or make it meaningless. In this case, the mutual indemnity claims are broadly worded. We've cited in our brief the Illinois Supreme Court case, the Buenz case, which held that the term any and all claims should be given an expansive interpretation, including claims based on the party's own misconduct. And the language in this case says any and all claims. So if you look at that language and the context, it's clear that it would cover a claim that somebody intentionally omitted to furnish information to one of the other parties to the contract. There's a wonderful quote in the Buenz case where the Illinois Supreme Court says, "The words any and all are inclusive. Their conciseness does not limit their scope. Their coverage would not have been extended by making them more specific." In other words, there was no need for there to be more specific language than any and all claims. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Cueto?
May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Cueto. I represent Jimmy Connors. I'm here to ask this Court to affirm the decision of Justice Murphy, which dismissed this indemnity claim under a Rule 12b-6 motion. I do want to correct a couple of things that I think Mr. Kiyanka got wrong. One of which is when he said, we don't know what the amount of the underlying settlement was. We do know that. It's in the record. Even though the settlement agreement had a confidentiality term, when Mr. Brennan filed his lawsuit against my client, he put the entire release into the record. And so we know that Jimmy Connors paid $10.5 million to settle the case, the underlying case, in which Mr. Brennan and his law firm and one of his former partners, Ms. Cates, who is not a party here, sued him. It was an 11-year legal battle. One of the things that I will agree with Mr. Kiyanka on when he said that that this court is to basically enforce the ordinary expectations of reasonable people. I hope I'm quoting him correctly. I wrote it down. I'm bad at taking notes. But the ordinary expectation of a reasonable person who pays $10.5 million to settle a case is not that they get dragged back into a lawsuit when the person they're settling with, their former partner, says, you cheated me out of that firm asset. You cheated me out of that firm asset. I want what's owed to me. I think the ordinary expectation of a reasonable person who pays $10.5 million is they're done. If Mr. Kiyanka and his client were to persist in saying that absent this indemnity, the $10.5 million settlement is a nullity, if they were to present that to my client, they might get a favorable ear. But I do want to suggest that he was mistaken when he said we don't know what the amount is. Obviously, this case is governed by Illinois law. The substantive law of Illinois governs this case. Respectfully, the categories that Mr. Kiyanka suggests apply here of past misconduct can be indemnified for, but future misconduct, all of the Illinois rules which govern indemnification for intentional torts and negligence torts, they apply only to future misconduct and not the past. Respectfully, that is a radical departure from Illinois law. Under the familiar Erie v. Tompkins principles, this court has to predict what the Illinois Supreme Court would do. Well, the Illinois Supreme Court, in a case that each of us cited, by the way, Benz v. Frontline Transport, stated, I'm going to quote it directly, it serves no useful purpose to analyze or reconcile the numerous cases interpreting indemnity clauses, since each individual case depends upon the particular language used and the factual setting of the case. Therefore, I think that the Illinois Supreme Court has explicitly rejected this notion of past versus future. One can be indemnified for, the other there is a public policy against. That led to the sparring both below in our briefs on whether this is a novel claim or not, and I think that's well briefed. But I think that the approach, it's important to realize here that the approach that Mr. Brennan advocates is outside Illinois law. Instead, if you look at the particular language that's used, under Benz, you look at the particular language in the factual setting. And when you look at the language of an indemnity clause, all of Illinois law says that it's strictly construed against indemnity, that there has to be almost, well, an explicit thing, especially for an intentional tort. Honestly, most of the cases here, most of the cases that we all cite, have to do with indemnifying one party for another party's negligence. I can find really almost no cases, and I don't think they cited any either, involving intentional torts. But the rules of construction are to construe things against indemnity, not in favor of it. A good example of how you look at the particular language and then the factual setting to determine these disputes is a case from this court, the Chicago Housing Authority case versus FSI. In that particular case, there was an explicit, and they upheld an indemnity. Really, it's one of the few cases I know where an indemnity for intentional torts was upheld. The underlying case in that involved a shooting with a civil rights claim underneath it, and there has to be, as I'm sure this court knows much more better than me, under 1983, at least somewhat of an intent to deprive someone of their constitutional rights. Chicago Housing Authority had contracted with this outfit to run its housing project, and there was an explicit agreement between the parties that intentional torts would be indemnified. So in that particular case, the court here sitting, applying Illinois law, said, okay, we can find the explicit authority to do this in the clause, which is not in our clause, by the way, when you read our clause. And then they looked at the factual setting of the case, and they stated since FSI, the indemnifying party, was the primary wrongdoer, it was FSI agents which shot this young man, they said that the factual setting of that case did not impinge or obstruct the general Illinois policy against indemnifying one for intentional conduct. If you look at it here, and by the way, that case also stated, and I quoted it in the brief, that the Illinois Supreme Court has already held that generally actions for indemnity for negligence and intentional torts is against public policy. If you look at the factual setting of this case, Mr. Kiyanka accused me of hyperbole, but I don't think it's hyperbole at all. All I'm doing is quoting from the allegations that his former law partner, that Mr. Brennan's former law partner, is advocating against me. And it's not just an omission fraud. Even if it were, there's really no legal distinction between a fraud of omission or a fraud of commission. But in this particular case, Mr. Brennan is accused, and all we can do is cite the underlying Constance complaint. Mr. Brennan is accused of, sure, omitting to tell his partner that Mr. Connors had at one time tendered all 458,333 shares of Argosy stock, that he had done that. Mr. Constance accuses him of omitting to tell him of that when he should have, because they had a fiduciary duties to one another. And then, though, he is also accused of acts that are certainly of commission. He is accused of lying about that under oath. He's accused of lying about that under oath to later protect, after the law firm was dissolving, to go back to his client and say, Jimmy, pay me now. That's what he's accused of. It's not hyperbole to say that. That's what the record suggests. Well, that doesn't suggest. That's what the record is. And so when you look at the particular language used here and the factual setting of this case, which is the approach that one has to use rather than these categories that are very creatively put forth, then if you look at it in that term, then there can be no indemnity here, especially for punitive damages. Mr. Constance's complaint asked for punitive damages. I can find there's no support. I don't even think Illinois law would allow an insurance company to insure against the risk for punitive damages. That's what's at issue here. If I could suggest the reason that these mutual indemnities occur, when you look at the actual clause, first of all, I think that the plaintiffs make a big mistake, or the plaintiff, excuse me, makes a big mistake when they don't analyze all three sentences of the indemnity clause. They cite the entire indemnity clause, which does contain three sentences, but they never discuss the first sentence. The first sentence states that the parties warrant that they own the rights that are asserted in that lawsuit and that they have not assigned those rights to anyone else. That's the first sentence. Thereafter occur the two mutual indemnifying clauses. If I could, the reason that Mr. Connors wants an indemnity, or that Mr. Brennan is owed an indemnity, is it's only for the future legal services that Mr. Brennan agreed to perform under the underlying representation agreement. The dispute between Connors and Brennan, when Brennan was suing Connors for unpaid legal fees, had to do with a written representation agreement. It's a heck of an agreement. I litigated it for 5 or 6 years. But it provided that in return for this kind of stupendous recovery, 20% of Jimmy Connors' ownership in the first riverboat casino in the state of Illinois, Mr. Brennan was to perform a myriad of future legal services for life. I think that this court, they reflected, the lower court, that Jimmy Connors is an internationally known tennis star. Mr. Brennan had contracted to be Jimmy Connors' lawyer for life for all present and future contracts. That's what he agreed to do. I mean, he agreed to represent Gloria Connors, Jimmy's mother, basically for life. It's kind of vague. I'll represent with all the interests of Gloria Connors, as well as perform all legal work for Mr. Connors' tennis corporation, Tennis Management, Inc. So there was this concept of future legal services that Mr. Brennan was to perform in return for this fee. When the case was settled, what Mr. Brennan is owed an indemnity to, because the ordinary expectations of reasonable people is we're done with one another. You go your way, I go mine. That, therefore, then, if for example, Tennis Management, Inc. came back to Mr. Brennan and said, I want you, Mr. Brennan, to do some legal work for me. He could point to the settlement and say, no, I don't have to. If an assignee of Jimmy Connors, or if Jimmy, you know, if he came and said, Mr. Brennan, I have a contract to do announcing for the tennis channel at the U.S. Open. Would you review it for me? Mr. Brennan can say, no, I don't have to. And if Mr. Connors tried to assign that to anyone else, then he can invoke the indemnity. But the first sentence is what relates to that. When the first sentence, the parties say to one another, look, we're warranting that we own all the rights that are asserted in the lawsuits, and Mr. Connors also had counterclaims, by the way, and affirmative defenses in the underlying lawsuit. Then the other two sentences modify that to the extent that say, because it even says, plaintiffs further declare that in the event something else happens, you know, Mr. Brennan would owe Jimmy Connors an indemnity if Mr. Constance sued him and said, under the rights, and said, Jimmy, I want money for this representation agreement. Then Jimmy could look to Mr. Brennan because Mr. Brennan had warranted that he owned all the rights from that representation agreement. He owned the rights of Brennan, Cates, and Constance's right to recover under the thing. Brennan, Cates, and Constance was a party in the initial lawsuit. And that's why, too, if you look at the last clause, and the one thing the district court didn't touch, in the event that it does go back, I mean, this part of the case is undecided, the mutual indemnities are for actions regarding the contract, or in Mr. Connors' case, regarding the contract and the obligations or the claims that were brought under the affirmative defenses and counterclaims. And candidly, Mr. Constance's lawsuit really has nothing to do with the contract. And that's the only thing that can be indemnified. Mr. Constance isn't claiming I own a right to, or Jimmy Connors owes me money under the contract. What he's claiming is he has no rights to compensation under that initial contract between Connors and Brennan for this 20% of the Argosy holdings. What he's saying is, Mr. Brennan, you cheated me. That's not a claim under the contract. That's a claim saying that's a firm asset, and you cheated me out of it. And the other thing I would point out is the Constance release is extrinsic evidence. There was never a finding. The plaintiff never asked Judge Murphy to find an ambiguity in the contract such that extrinsic evidence is allowed. They've argued a lot of extrinsic evidence here, both here and in their brief, and that just wasn't the case. That's not. There's no basis to do that. And I would also just want to point out too that I think that they are asking this court to conduct or to go so far afield from what Illinois law allows. Again, when construing an indemnity contract, the Westinghouse case, which is an Illinois Supreme Court case cited by the Seventh Circuit and the Chicago Housing Authority, says that you construe these very narrowly. In their reply brief, and when they talked about CHA and this very issue, they actually said, where indemnity for past conduct is concerned, the policy concerns applicable to indemnity against future misconduct are inapplicable. This includes any policy requiring a specific reference to intentional acts in the indemnity agreement itself. What they're asking actually this court to do is not just radically depart from the notion of what can be and can't be indemnified. They're actually asking this court as well to depart from the rules of construction on how to read an indemnity agreement. I'm afraid I'd just be repeating myself if I went on, barring any questions.
I can see why this lawsuit dragged on for 11 years.
Okay. Well, barring any further questions, I'll... Are any questions?
Thank you, Your Honor. So many things to reply to in so little time. I would just like to make a couple of quick points here. First, he says there's no claim under the contract, but if you read the agreement, it's the subject matter of the contract And the stock, which is the subject matter of the contract, there's no question about the fact that the indemnity agreement covers this particular situation. As to the extrinsic evidence point, if the agreement is not ambiguous, if it's unambiguous, then on its face it covers this situation. We think, that, therefore, that either way, either it's ambiguous, unambiguous, or if it's ambiguous, then the court is permitted to look at extrinsic evidence, and that's an issue of law. So this court can look at that evidence. The Chicago Housing Authority case, as we've said in our reply brief, is simply inapplicable here because it does what the defendant has continually tried to do in this case, which is deflect attention from the distinction between past and future conduct. And that's the key in this case. And we have cited all kinds of cases. This is not novel law. The law is well settled nationally. Williston and others agree that if we're talking about past conduct, the parties are free to allocate those risks as they see fit.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks to both.